Good morning and welcome to the Thursday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Hillary Clinton helped fund the Trump dossier. Here's what you should know about it. By Maya Roden. Months of speculation were confirmed late Tuesday when reports established that Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign and the Democratic National Committee helped fund an infamous dossier that contains salacious and unsubstantiated allegations about President Donald Trump's ties to Russia. The Washington Post reported that in April 2016, an attorney for both the Clinton campaign and the DNC retained a research firm to gather intel on Trump, who was then on his way to the Republican presidential nomination. Later, a former British spy named Christopher Steele was hired and compiled a dossier document that claimed Russia had information it could use to blackmail Trump, among other things. Trump tweeted, "Clinton campaign and DNC paid for research that led to the anti-Trump fake news dossier. The victim here is the president." If you are scratching your head about what it all means and what is allegedly in the Trump dossier, we're here to help. What is the Trump dossier? The Trump dossier is a 35-page research document that claims the Russian government had been cultivating, supporting, and assisting Trump for years. It also says the Kremlin has information it can use against Trump as blackmail. The claims in the Trump dossier, which was published in full by BuzzFeed News in January, have not been verified. Trump has dismissed the dossier as fake news. Who knew about the Trump dossier? Information included within the Trump dossier reportedly began making the rounds in Washington in the thick of the 2016 presidential campaign, just as the intelligence community began looking into potential connections between the Kremlin and Trump, connections Trump has consistently denied. The Post reports Steele shared some of his dossier findings with the FBI during the campaign. The agency agreed to hire him to collect more information after the election, only to back away once he was revealed as the author of the dossier. Trump tweeted, "Workers of firm involved with a discredited and fake dossier take the fifth. Who paid for it? Russia, the FBI, or the Dems, or all?" A two-page summary of the dossier was presented to both President Barack Obama and then-President-elect Trump by top intelligence officials in January. CNN first reported that a dossier summary was given, a briefing that was later confirmed by Vice President Joe Biden. What was Hillary Clinton's involvement with the Trump dossier? According to the Post, Steele was not brought on to conduct research about Trump until after Clinton and DNC lawyer Mark Elias retained the research firm Fusion GPS, which hired him. A spokesman for the Clinton campaign denied having information on the dossier during the campaign, but told the Post that had he known about it, he would have had no issue handing it over to reporters. Opposition research happens on every campaign, and here you had probably the most shadowy guy ever running for president, and the FBI certainly has seen fit to look into it, former Clinton spokesman Brian Fallon said. I probably would have volunteered to go to Europe myself to try and verify if it would have helped get more of this out there before the election. The DNC also told the Post in a statement that the current party chair had nothing to do with Fusion GPS and had no knowledge of Elias's law firm's involvement. But let's be clear, there is a serious federal investigation into the Trump campaign's ties to Russia, and the American public deserves to know what happened, the statement reads. Has the Trump dossier come up in investigations? The Trump dossier has also come up amid the federal and congressional investigations into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Investigators working for Special Counsel Robert Mueller have reportedly interviewed Steele in Europe. Reuters reports his team is looking into details of the dossier document. Mueller is investigating whether Trump associates colluded with Russian agents to influence the election, something Trump has also repeatedly denied. Last week, an attorney for Fusion GPS sent a letter to the House Intelligence Committee that suggested it has no plans to cooperate with its investigation. In the letter, the attorney also accused the panel of being more interested in finding out who funded the Trump dossier than investigating actual Russian interference, according to the Associated Press. The attorney said if fusion leaders were subpoenaed by the panel, they would refuse to testify by invoking their Fifth Amendment rights.
Tax reform supporters target vulnerable Senate Democrats, by Philip Elliott. Despite assurances from President Trump that he has great unity with his Republican Party and optimism that tax reform are imminent on the horizon, a number of worries are arising among members of Congress, their political advisors, and the independent outside groups trying to shepherd the project to the finish line. So serious is the nervousness that one group, backed by the billionaire small government brothers Charles and David Koch, is announcing $1.6 million advertising blitz for Wisconsin on Thursday. The goal, officials say, is to either convince Senator Tammy Baldwin to support the tax reform this year or to damage the Democrats' re-election odds next year. Hardworking families simply can't afford to be sending more to Washington. If Tammy Baldwin opposes tax reform, it's proof that she opposes jobs. She opposes higher wages, a Wisconsin businessman says in one of the two 30-second ads. In the other spot, the narrator says Baldwin is part of a rigged system standing in the way of lower taxes. The rhetoric of Washington versus the people has been at the fore of Koch advertising in recent weeks, including a six-figure ad blitz in the Washington area shaming lawmakers for listening to lobbyists. It's standard fare but remarkable because it joins the now $10 million the Koch-backed network of policy and political organizations have spent trying to push an overhaul to the tax system. Lawmakers face a steep hill to get the tax reform legislation across the finish line by the end of the year. Failing to do so, however, could carry a steeper price when voters next year consider if the all-Republican Washington deserves to hold on to power. The threat or returning to the political minority consumes much of the wise pollsters and consultants around the Republican caucus at the Capitol. Republicans took back the House with 2010's Tea Party wave and the Senate in 2014. They campaigned on the promise of a conservative agenda, only to run into the wall of Barack Obama's White House. The GOP switched its tune, saying they could only get things done with the Republican president. That has not helped. Trump visited Senate Republicans on Tuesday in what he described as a love fest that featured cheers and standing ovations. Former White House photographer Pete Souza, who worked for Barack Obama, posted a photograph of Senate Republicans showing the same respect for the Democratic president in 2009. Senate officials, however, were flummoxed by the move and frustrated by the president's comments. Several described a campaign-style speech that listed some of Trump's greatest hits without worrying too much about the details on a tax plan the president was asking them to back. How it helped win a legislative win for Republicans in Congress was anyone's guess. Meanwhile, several members of GOP leadership were grimacing that the president was focused on personal feuds with two of their colleagues, Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee and Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona. Both have now announced their retirements from Congress rather than face voters next year, and several Republican strategists suspect they won't be the last. Corker, the chairman of the powerful Foreign Relations panel in the Senate, and Flake have been frequent targets of Trump's tirades, and they have started hitting back. Members of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's inner circle smile when they see the fire in Corker and Flake, as well as recent comments from former President George W. Bush and Senator John McCain of Arizona. But the truth-telling also threatens the party's ability to deliver tax cuts this year. For many in the best GOP offices, the fight over the party's future can wait until they've delivered at least one hallmark promise, one on which they and their outside allies can point to when they face voters next year. Even with 52 votes in the Senate, Republicans are still not assured they can get to 50 ayes to clear the tax package. Vice President Mike Pence, a Republican, would break the tie and put it over the edge. For one, Senators Thad Cochran of Mississippi has faced health challenges this year. Senator Luther Strange of Alabama will see his appointment expire when voters in Dixie elect a permanent replacement for Jeff Sessions, who stepped away from the Senate to become the nation's attorney general. Republican nominee Roy Moore is not a guaranteed supporter. At the same time, Corker and Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky are no fan of the tax plan's red ink. Flake could balk at it as well, and McCain has been fighting cancer. The Republicans could already be well below 50 votes before they even have a firm grasp on the plan. For his part, The president is not much better. Before leaving for Texas on Wednesday afternoon, Trump met for an impromptu 15-minute news conference on the South Lawn. During that time, he disagreed with House Budget Committee Chairman Kevin Brady on how retirement funds would fare in the tax plan. Bette Flake would vote for it and said he enjoyed a chat with McCain a day earlier. He then said he wanted to negotiate with Brady, called Flake's book horrible, and blamed the media for reports of division within GOP ranks. Then, after a broadside against his 2016 Democratic rival Hillary Clinton, Trump said he wanted Democrats to vote for the tax cuts too. While admitting he hasn't started working those Democrats for their support, he offered a warning. If they don't vote for these massive tax cuts for business, for jobs, and for the middle class, they will lose their races in 18, the president predicted before pacing to his waiting helicopter. The Koch-backed groups disagree with the president's tone, but they share his assessment of Democrats' potential weakness on this issue. It remains to be seen if the Democrats do too.
A Christian college just rolled out a mandatory military patriotism class by Katie Riley. A private Christian college in Missouri is rolling out a mandatory military science course aimed at encouraging patriotism, making it a requirement for all freshmen. We think there needs to be a more intentional program regarding our country and especially the military, College of the Ozarks President Jerry Davis told Time on Wednesday. We don't think the military has been properly recognized, and students in general need to know more about the place of the military in the democracy. The course, called Patriotic Education and Fitness, combines the school prior physical education and patriotism requirements, and adds more military training, such as rifle marksmanship, land navigation, and ropes climbing. The course will also cover military customs and flag protocol. The college strives to encourage an understanding of American heritage, civic responsibilities, love of country, and willingness to defend it, according to its mission statement. To train a better citizen, so to speak. I don't think there's a better way to do that than to remind students of the importance of the military and to be respectful of the country in which we live, Davis said. Otherwise, this division that we all see in this culture will do great damage to the United States. Davis spoke out in September against athletes who have knelt during the national anthem to protest racial injustice and police violence, declaring that the school would not play any team whose players don't stand for the anthem. Controversy over such protests escalated last month when President Trump accused players who protest during the national anthem of being unpatriotic and disrespectful. But Davis said the school's new patriotism course, which was piloted last year, is not a response to those protests. I can tell you the students here, even during athletic events, have practiced respect for this country long before it was developed as an issue this year, Davis said. It's not something that we just dreamed up as a reaction to something. He says he hopes to see other universities copy the new class. I think more colleges and universities need to make it their business to be more intentional about teaching about the country, about the military, he said.
Xi Jinping designates no obvious successor, laying the foundation for a long reign, by Charlie Campbell in Beijing. Chinese President Xi Jinping, who on Tuesday became his nation's strongest leader since Mao Zedong, has set the wheels in motion for staying in power beyond his second five-year term by not appointing any young cadres to the top leadership committee of the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP. Following the culmination of the CCP's 19th Congress on Tuesday, China's apex seven-member Politburo Standing Committee, PSC, was presented to assembled press Wednesday morning without any members below the age of 57, making it less likely that a leadership transition will occur at the 20th Congress in 2022. Addressing the press after the unveiling, Xi did not make any mention of the omission of younger cadres, preferring to concentrate on his goals for China's new era that he defined during the Congress, when Xi had his signature political thought added to the National Constitution, an act that puts the 64-year-old in the same lofty bracket as Founding Father Mao. On the march toward common prosperity, no one must be left behind. We will mobilize the whole party and country to deliver on our pledge to eradicate poverty in China, Xi told the flashing cameras of assembled journalists in Beijing's Great Hall of the People, though with some high-profile international media, including the BBC, New York Times, and UK Guardian, denied access. The aspirations of the people to live a better life must always be the focus of our efforts, he added. The new PSC is comprised of Xi Jinping, Li Qiang, Li Shanshu, Wang Yang, Wang Huning, Han Zheng, and Zhao Leji, with the latter the youngest member at 60 years old. But the unofficial PSC retirement age at a party congress is 68, meaning any cadres must be aged 57 now in order to stay on the Apex Committee for 3 terms, as would be required of future presidents and premiers. Xi and Li Qiang were both younger than 57 upon joining the PSC at the 17th Party Congress in 2007, when they were blooded on the PSC for a full term before ascending to the top jobs, also as convention dictates. Xi Jinping has no intention of relinquishing power at the 20th Party Congress 5 years from now, says Professor Steve Tsang, director of the SOAS China Institute at the University of London. The only question is how he will stay. Xi's determination to stay on as leader and his grip on power are so apparent that potential future leaders have been cowed from coming forward. One likely successor, Sun Zhengkai, was purged from his role of boss of the central metropolis of Chongqing in the run-up to the Congress, a move which sent a chill through party ranks. There are also rumors that another possible heir, Hu Chunhua, has been actively trying to avoid the limelight. Who's a very smart politician in terms of self-preservation, adds Tsang. If you know that there's no chance that you could actually be a successor, then why would you risk putting your head on the chopping block? That's just about the most dangerous, vulnerable place you could be in Chinese politics. It wasn't simply a Xi Jinping whitewash, however. 3 of the 7 PSC members loosely belong to CCP's Youth League faction, rising up through the ranks of the party's junior organization. Xi, by contrast, is a representative of the Princeling faction, comprising scions of the CCP's storied founders. Premier Li Qiang, Vice Premier Wang Yang, and Shanghai Chief Han Zheng are all loosely affiliated with the former, and thus are not stone-cold Xi protégés. But Li Qiang has, if you like, been house-trained, says Tsang, and neither Wang Yang nor Han Zhen will be able to do very much in terms of opposing Xi Jinping. Want to get paid to travel? This airline is hiring more than 1,000 flight attendants. By Mahita Gajanan. For those who are travel-inclined and looking for work, Delta Airlines is hiring more than 1,000 crew members for 2018. Delta flight attendant applicants must be at least 21 by January 1st, have more than 1 year of experience in customer service, patient care, or caring for someone, and education beyond high school. Fluency in a language other than English is also a plus. Although more than 1,000 open positions seems like a lot, Delta says it has received more than 125,000 applications already, according to CNN Money. Delta hired about 1,200 flight attendants from a pool of 150,000 applicants last year after reviewing 35,000 video interviews and 6,000 in-person interviews. Earning and wearing the wings of Delta is something our flight attendants are proud of and passionate about, as they should be, Allison Osband, Delta Senior Vice President of In-Flight Service, said in a statement. After making it through the highly competitive and exhaustive selection process, they put all their previous experience and skills to the test during our flight attendant initial training. Boost your productivity at work with this 5-minute routine by Richard Moy for The Muse. When you're not feeling like yourself at work, it seems impossible to bounce back. You think to yourself, tomorrow's a new day, but for now, I'm just going to stare at GIFs of kittens. But don't throw in the towel for the day just yet. Because if you have 5 minutes, and it sounds like you do, you can try this energy-boosting routine. It's so jam-packed with activities that it'll be hard to end it without feeling like you can take on anything. Or, if not anything, at least get through your next project. 1 minute, stand up and stretch. Great, another person telling you to get more exercise, right? Before you jump to any conclusions, hear me out. You don't need to run a marathon to energize yourself at work. In fact, according to a Forbes article, sports scientist Jake Groppel says that short movements throughout your workday can boost energy, engagement, and efficiency. For some people, that might mean standing up periodically. For others, it might require you to take a lap around the office. But don't get too caught up on the type of activity you do, and especially don't worry about the duration. Just get yourself moving for 60 seconds. 2 minutes, complete a short online errand. Is there an Amazon order you've been meaning to complete? Do you have a bill that you know is due in the next day or two? Did your mother ask you to send her an article on how to reset the wireless again? Choose one of those short errands and spend 2 minutes completing it. I don't know about you, but I get a boost of energy anytime I can check something off my to-do list, especially when it's on my personal checklist. Plus, when you leave the office at the end of the day, you'll have more time to do something for yourself. And trust me, buying shampoo on the internet does not count as self-care. 1 minute, write down your weekend plans. This sounds counterproductive, but hear me out. If you're low on energy, you're probably lacking the motivation to get anything done as well. And I've found that when I'm not feeling motivated, thinking about my weekend plans gives me a jolt. You might have something really fun on the docket, or you might have 2 days of nothing ahead of you. Neither one is wrong, but no matter what's going on, write it down on a sticky note and put it on your monitor. You'll be surprised how much harder you'll work when you know there's a reminder that a reward is getting closer and closer. 1 minute, text a friend. Check in with someone you care about. Maybe you've given someone radio silence by accident after they asked you a question. Or maybe you just need to tell someone that you don't have a ton of energy right now. My closest friends and I use a group chat app to tell bad jokes and update each other on our lives. And when I just want to put my head down and take a nap at work, nothing boosts my energy more than getting in on the action. 5 minutes might not seem like a lot of time to energize yourself, especially when all you want to do is go home for the day. But even if you give it a try, you might just find yourself with the boost you need to crush the rest of the day. And the best part is that over time, it'll become more of a habit than a practice. When that happens, the pressure of merely powering through a tough day at work will fall on your shoulders far less often. If you give these tips a shot, let me know how it goes on Twitter. This article originally appeared on themuse.com. It could have been avoided. 3-year-old boy dies after getting trapped in park's underground water tank. By Melissa Chan. A 3-year-old Florida boy who died after getting trapped in a water-holding tank was remembered Tuesday as a smart and curious child. Amari Harley went missing Sunday during a family event at a local park shortly after a sudden downpour of rain scattered those who had gathered for an annual kickball game, his family said. Relatives fanned out to look for Amari at about 5 p.m. and called the police when he couldn't be found. Hours later, Amari's body was discovered in an underground water-holding tank inside the park, which city officials had drained to find him, the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office said at a news conference. The opening of the tank is large enough for a child to fit inside, authorities said, but it's a mystery to authorities and the boy's family how he ended up inside the tank. "I was confused, lost, hurt," Amari's mother, Jasmine Bates, told Time on Tuesday. "It could have been avoided. He shouldn't have been able to do that." Bates, 25, said she had just bought Amari a Ninja Turtle costume for Halloween, which he was excited to wear this year. But the toddler never got a chance to put it on. "We still have it hanging up," Bates said. Amari's grandmother, Michelle Kelsey, said Amari was quiet for the most part, but his thirst for knowledge made him speak up. "He asked a lot of questions. He was very curious," she said. "He always wanted to ask why." The city is investigating Amari's death. Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry said officials will always work to ensure safety and security in our parks. Kelsey said she's in a state of shock over what happened. "It's the worst thing, news you can never hear," she said. "It's painful." Why More Men Don't Stick Up for Women Who Are Being Sexually Harassed by Jackson Katz. Men often ask me what they can do to be supportive of women close to them who have been sexually or physically assaulted by other men. I often tell them what I learned long ago from advocates and social workers in the sexual assault and domestic violence fields. You should listen quietly and intently to whatever women want to share about their experiences and reassure them that you're most concerned about their well-being. Then gently ask what you can do to help. The idea is not to jump in and try to fix the problem, but to let her know you care about her and support her in whatever way she deems most useful. In many instances, women who have been abused by men have already suffered a loss of control at the hands of an abuser. The last thing they need is for another man to jump in and seek to reassert control, however well-meaning he might be. But men can and should do a lot more than provide compassionate support for survivors. In response to the explosion of the MeToo hashtag, in which millions of women and girls around the world have identified themselves as survivors of various forms of harassment and violence, men themselves have displayed a spectrum of emotions. These range from predictable denial and minimization of the issue, all the way to full-fledged expressions of empathy and a desire to, finally, take more of a stand against pervasive misogyny. It is this latter response that has the most potential for transformative change. Of course, it's important for a man, whether he's a family member, lover, or friend, to be there for a woman who needs to be heard. But the true test of men's commitment to the women and girls in our lives is whether we can take our empathy to the next level and actually do something to address men's violence against women. Though women are the ones speaking up en masse about their experiences, the burden of changing the culture of abuse should not be on the shoulders of survivors. In the vast majority of cases of sexual harassment and sexual assault, men are the primary perpetrators, whether the victims are women or men. It is therefore men's, all men's, responsibility to do their part in preventing it from happening in the first place. That means first having the moral integrity to look inward and be introspective about how our own attitudes and beliefs might be part of the problem. Then it means finding the courage to challenge and interrupt other men's sexism, including when we see manifestations of it among our friends, colleagues, and others in our peer culture. This is a lot harder than it might first appear, because there's a reason why so few men to date have spoken out about men's violence toward women. It's not just that men didn't know how big of a problem this is. Sure, the MeToo hashtag has catalyzed a giant consciousness-raising moment. One day it might be understood as a watershed moment for progressive social change. But millions of men have known for a long time that women around them experience sexist abuse in their everyday lives. They've probably witnessed it at work, in a bar, or on the street. They might even be guilty of some of this behavior themselves. Yet few men have seen fit to make these issues a true priority in either their personal or professional lives. The reason why so few men have been willing to break their complicit silence on these matters is that too many of them fear the social backlash they face from other men when they choose to stand with women as their partners and allies in the struggle against abuse. The hashtag #HowWillIChange, which men are using to publicly address how they'll change their behavior in response to MeToo, is a step in the right direction. But in coming days, months, and years, the true test of whether men have what it takes to truly support women is whether or not a critical mass of them are willing to take a stand and make it clear to other men that they will no longer participate in or condone sexist behavior in any of its forms. Only then will we truly change the culture that has hurt so many women for far too long. Jackson Katz is an educator, author, and the co-founder of Mentors in Violence Prevention, MVP. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, Enjoy the day.